Good afternoon, and thanks for attending our session. Today we are addressing the challenges and rewards of open source digital video preservation. We have three presenters today. Cindy McClung, who is the project archivist for the City of Vancouver Archives, will be talking about a project that they undertook to preserve videotapes within their archive and some of the challenges associated with selecting those videotapes, as well as choosing a method of preservation and of access. In addition to Cindy, Dave Rice, who at the time was with Audiovisual Preservation Solutions and helped the City of Vancouver evaluate and choose a particular format for preservation. Cindy's going to talk about the necessary steps when preparing for a project like this, and Dave will talk about an introduction to lossless video codecs, an analysis of the relevance and the risk involved with different codecs, as well as an overview and evaluation of criteria in selection of specific codecs. And my name's John Walco. I am with a company called Scene Savers. We actually help them bring all this together by creating a solution to create the digital files and work very closely with them in figuring out how to get the materials, what metadata capture, and how to get the materials back to them. We don't have a lot of time today. I actually thought our session was a little bit longer than an hour, and once we figured out that it actually was an hour, we had to reduce our presentation times a little bit. So I would ask that you please hold your questions till the end. We're going to try to limit our presentations to about 15 minutes each, so we should have hopefully about 15 minutes at the end for question and answers. So again, thanks for attending, and Cindy McClellan from the City of Vancouver Archives.
Can you hear me? Is the microphone? Okay, excellent. Thanks everybody for sticking in for the last day today. And I'm going to talk about how we at the City of Vancouver Archives are preserving video digitally. Just a little context about the City of Vancouver Archives. It's a Canadian total archives. Our mandate includes the records of the city with long-term business value, as well as records from families and individuals and businesses that document the life, culture, and business of the Vancouver and area. I will stick to our workflow, decision-making processes, sharing some useful tools, and I'm going to begin with a brief introduction to the Yaletown Productions records collection, the main reason that the archives had to come up with a plan for preserving video over the long term. So the City of Vancouver Archives was incorporated in 1886, and last year was the city's 125th birthday, which was celebrated throughout Vancouver with events all year round. And of course, the City of Vancouver Archives contributed in many ways, and one way was to preserve and make available the records of Yaletown Productions, Inc., a local film production company. And the project wound up with a screening curated by the donor, Michael Collier, a retrospective of his 40-year career in the Vancouver film business. And the Yaletown records that Collier donated reflect the thriving film industry in Vancouver. This is a photo that I took of a few of the video formats we received in the donation. The donation also included a hard drive, which I'm anticipating processing through Archivematica when I get back in Vancouver, 3 meters of textual records, photographs, hundreds of moving image materials, including 16 and 35 millimeter film, a 12-inch laser disc, various audio formats, and video, more video than anything else. And when you're dealing with video, before you make any big decisions or even begin to get an estimate of how much digitization will cost, it's important to gather as much information as you can about what you have. And here the first spreadsheet begins. So in addition to assigning numbers for control purposes, it's useful to try and find titles for everything, as well as their type, format, length in minutes, any other condition notes, including notes about the availability of instances of specific titles in various formats. It's nice to have options when you're digitizing. With the production company records, we had many, many copies and multiple versions of everything in the donation. The Texas Commission on the Arts has a very nice assessment guide and a handy set of pictures for identifying U-matic versus Betacam versus DVC Pro, etc., and I highly recommend it. It's called Texas Commission on the Arts Videotape Identification and Assessment Guide, so it's well-named. When you're inspecting a video for the first time, you want to look at the case first and see if it's cracked or broken, or is it melted from a fire? I've actually seen that. And then the condition of the tape itself. When you open it up, do you get a weird smell? Is there a white powder inside the case? And if you can actually see in through the window, if nobody's put a sticker on top or something, what does the tape look like? Stepped pack is a common issue where the tape can be seen to be wound in different levels. Also, pop strands, where one piece of tape sticks up and is susceptible to damage, and warping. This is a particularly nasty example. I was very lucky in that I had the privilege of working with a knowledgeable and helpful donor. Over the course of several meetings with Mike, it was determined which moving image items were duplicates, originals, masters, working copies, raw footage, finished products, and generally which versions would be the best quality and most useful materials to digitize. Without input from the creator or someone with a close relationship to the videos and their creation, it is difficult to determine all of these things. Even with labels on the case and the tape, there's no guarantee that the content on the tape matches the label. So I'm going to digress and tell you a short story about another project involving video at the archives. Some of you might have heard that we had the Winter Olympics in Vancouver in 2010, and we got all the records, and there were terabytes and boxes, so much stuff. But in there were several tapes labeled with event names, and they were duly flagged to be copied as the events were all key Vancouver Olympic Committee events. However, it turned out that the tapes were merely played at these events, and they contained nothing more than an unmoving and unchanging screenshot of the Vancouver Olympic Committee logo. Hours of it. Which you wouldn't know without expensive, hard to get a hold of, and proprietary hardware. I was privileged in another way with the Yaletown records, in that the donor kept good records, and those items that he owned copyright to, he signed over to the City of Vancouver. We did preserve some items that Mike did not have copyright to, and these can only be viewed in the archives reading room. Copyright is often of concern when preserving video. It can be hard to justify spending the money when you can only provide limited access. Copyright is an issue that needs to be carefully considered at the beginning of the project. And I also recommend a big pot of tea or maybe some scotch and an afternoon of reading. Just the relevant sections and definitions. The definitions are my favorite. Who is the author of a movie? please note that my experience is limited to Canadian copyright law, although because of the Internet Archive, I'm finding it necessary to educate myself since our movies will be stored in the States. We have to comply with your laws. And we will be posting all of the Yaletown Productions material that we can to the Internet Archive so we can share it more widely. It's so tempting to draw comparisons between the two laws, but when it comes to dates, it just gets super confusing. They do both allow archives and libraries a small amount of wiggle room with regard to allowing for copying for purposes of preservation and providing access for research and education. So you guys check out sections 107 and 108. One nice clear-cut fact is that works published before 1923 are in public domain. For those of us in the video preservation field, this fact does us very little good. The term of copyright, however, has gone from 28 years to 120 years for works created by a corporation, or 95 years after publication, whichever is shorter. And if this graph is anything to go by, it's just going to get longer. So the reason that I'm focusing on video rather than film, and we do have a lot of film at the City of Vancouver, is because it's, with film, you just package it up properly, throw it in the freezer, and it's good for hundreds of years. You can thaw it out again, you could just hold it up to the light and look at it, or find a simple movie scope. Video, you can't just look at it and know what's on it. The cassettes themselves do not last. They're little rubber and plastic pieces inside the cassette that break down and cause damage and that can be hard to replace or fix. And the tape itself is fragile and wears with being played, time, heat, moisture, cold. Never mind the fact finding a working playback machine for all of the many and various formats. The solution at the City of Vancouver Archives is digital preservation. Of course, digital preservation is no walk in the park either. As you are all well aware, digital preservation requires constant vigilance, continuous format migration, planning, hardware, software, people with expertise, and of course, money. Digitized video is only one of many digital preservation commitments the City of Vancouver Archives has. Born digital records from the city's EDRMS will arrive in regular transfers, just as they did in pre-digital times. We also have the Olympic Committee records, which I briefly mentioned earlier, and they are mostly digital, and we have terabytes of them, and other digital assets, including more than 80,000 photographs, as well as audio materials and born digital materials from other sources. So this commitment to preserving digital records was firmly in place at the archives before the Yaletown project was taken on and before I joined the team. And firmly set within these commitments is embedded the commitment to operate in an open source software environment for digital preservation. The City of Vancouver Archives is using Archivematica as an OAIS model digital preservation repository system to enable sustainability and respond to obsolescence risks. And as part of the normal operation of Archivematica, the archives normalizes material to open and standardized file formats during ingest while maintaining the original source. With content that we are choosing to digitize rather than normalize from born digital materials, we wanted to begin with a format that was both open source and had sufficient free software to support it. The Yaletown project, with its Vancouver 125 birthday party funding, posed the perfect opportunity to invest in and develop our video preservation procedures. As of last summer and going forward, we no longer rely on continuing to invest in new DigiBeta tapes, being stuck in a cycle of making copies of copies, always on the edge of obsolescence. We digitize once and then migrate and maintain as necessary, along with all of our other digital assets. Although the archives is blessed with two regular full-time digital archivists and one digital conservator, none of them are moving image specialists, so we got some expert advice from Dave Rice during the decision-making processes. The archives understands that FFV1 has not endured a comparable standardization process to JPEG 2000. The archives has open software to decode and demultiplex FFV1 Matroska to both enable playback and access, as well as to enable a lossless transition from Matroska to JPEG 2000, or from FFV1 to JPEG 2000, when feasible, if and only if this is indeed the way the field is heading and JPEG 2000 software becomes open. We have found a small community of FFV1 users in the media preservation field, mostly in Europe, but also some here south of the border. We did successfully decode the MKV preservation files when curating the screening last November to celebrate the conclusion of this project that we had. And we played and manipulated the files and edited them in Apple's Final Cut Pro. So if you can play nice with Apple, it's all good. A hard drive with the clips we wanted in the final DigiBeta tape to be played at the screening was taken to a local vendor, and we stitched the clips together and added some text, and they made the tape for us. The little drama that we had before the screening mostly involved sending some 35mm film at the last minute to Kentucky for a better copy of Mike's student films. He dug more copies out of his basement after seeing how beat up the first versions he'd given us were. Deciding what information we wanted captured at digitization took quite a few meetings. There is, as of yet, no consensus of how much or how little information to capture, and as far as I can tell, we're somewhere in the middle with 8 fields. Some places include the name of the person responsible, which at the time of digitization might impart a certain amount of responsibility, but in the long term might not be relevant, so we just have the vendor name. We also wanted a controlled and comprehensive vocabulary for recording the format of each source item. In the end, we went with EBU. Even with its comprehensive list, measurements are not included. So an institution with only one size of video reel wouldn't know if it was small, medium, or large. And now a short break, because I talked about standards briefly. George Blood says, standards are like toothbrushes. Everyone agrees that they are a good idea, but no one wants to use the same one. Here are the basic specifications that we required from the vendor, taken from our 8-page document. We had the vendor create both an access copy in MP4, a much smaller and more manageable file, as well as the MKV preservation files. The files arrived at the archives on external hard drives, and I will take this opportunity to remind everyone to, we didn't find any viruses, but do virus checking when you introduce new things to your archives environment. Checksums were created by the vendor in a sidecard file, and then the archives staff verified each checksum. MD5 checker can be downloaded for free use in Linux, Windows, and Mac. I just wanted to mention a couple things about quality control. We waited until the QC was complete before the originals were returned to Vancouver. And I would also like to point people to AV Atlas. It's awesome. It has clips demonstrating the issues that can be had with video and what causes them and whether or not they can be fixed. Oh, I'm almost at my 15 minutes. So this is an example of some digitization metadata that we attach when we put a film through Archivematica. So this information created by the vendor would go in a sidecard file when it's processed through Archivematica. That's all I'm going to say about that. So this screenshot is how we organize the files, getting ready to put them through Archivematica. We have a main transfers directory, and then all of the different objects and associated files. We have a CSV file that lists the file name and then the item number so everything could get linked up. And then because we had the MP4s created by the vendor, we throw that in the access directory, and we don't need Archivematica to create an access version for us. And finally, you're ready to ingest in Archivematica. Yay! We do a maximum of 5 at a time. Oh, and the other thing I meant to mention was that when we're processing TIFFs through Archivematica, we generally do them in batches of 1,000. With video, we do them one at a time. That's how big the MKV files are. It's just a lot. Also, Archivematica is currently in release 0.8. 0.9 will be out in the fall, and then January we'll have a 1.0, and it'll be much more user-friendly. But the back end is all working fine. So basically, you put it in the transfers directory, you highlight, say, transfer complete, and then you wait a long time, and it processes, and you're done. Okay. The transfer, when it's processed all the way through successfully, you create an APE, an archival information package, and a DIP, a dissemination information package. And I'm going to stop there, except that I like to end with a little XKCD comic, and you probably can't read it, so I will do a dramatic reading. Error 41? That's helpful. It doesn't even say which program it's from. 41? I'll look it up. It says, 41 is sit by a lake. I don't know where you got that book, but I like it. Hasn't been wrong yet. So when you're embarking on digital preservation, make sure you build up a community and make friends and occasionally go sit by the ocean or something. Thank you.
You gonna do a timer for me too?
Sure.
Hi, everybody. I'm Dave Rice. I'm an audiovisual archivist currently at the City University of New York. But for the most of the time when I was participating in this project with these guys, I was at Audiovisual Preservation Solutions, which is like three blocks away from City University of New York. All right, presentation time. So I'm going to talk more specifically about FFV1 and considerations of its use of in digital preservation environments. I'm going to start with George quote too, but this is a quote by George Carlin that sometimes I find relevant to considerations of best practice advice in the digital preservation community. The quote is, kids have to be warned that there is bullshit coming down the road. That is the biggest thing you can do for a kid. Tell them that life in this country is about. It's about a whole lot of bullshit that needs to be detected and avoided. That's the best thing you can do. No one told me. No one told me a thing like that. I had to find out all this on my own. You know, I'm sure you've experienced this on listservs and in conversations, is that sometimes there's ideas that they're not necessarily the best ideas to apply in certain kinds of environments. All right. So after that, moving on. If you've heard about using lossless video codecs in digital preservation environments, then you've probably heard that, that the Library of Congress loves JPEG 2000. They've created tens of thousands of JPEG 2000 files as digital preservation masters coming from analog sources. And they do this by mostly using robots. This is what I imagine the robots look like. Not necessarily. But you know, you might be thinking that, you know, except for government mandate and budget and staffing, like that your archive is a lot like the Library of Congress, and you know, possibly these best practices, you know, should be used in other types of organizations. So I have this quote from Jimmy Jones, who is the current digital audiovisual format specialist at the Library of Congress. This is from a blog post he wrote last year, but he said, as dissatisfying as it is, there is as yet no good pat answer to digital video preservation, largely because the digital preservation world is so emergent. Efforts like the Federal Agency's Digitization Guidelines Initiative, MXF JPEG 2000 work, may help the digital preservation community to someday have a better answer to which digital format question, but for the moment, the right answer is more like is actually more of a best set of questions to ask. And then, you know, part of my advice is that in digital video preservation, at least at this time, best practices would be better called good enough for now practices. You know, for instance, the best practices that were used in the archive a decade ago, wouldn't necessarily be the best in the current technical environment. And similarly, like the decisions we as archivists are making today, we wouldn't necessarily assume that, you know, our future replacements in the distant future would consider in the same way. So for lossless video codecs, JPEG 2000, at least in the digital preservation community, gets... Oh, good, George is here. JPEG 2000 in the digital video preservation community is sort of like the most talked about codec for us. But in other environments, like Linux intermediate codecs and other environments, like there are more codecs available that are out there. Some are codecs like H.264 that do support lossless encoding at a variety of color spaces and bit depths and chroma subsampling patterns, but aren't necessarily widely used in lossless. As far as like what Cindy was saying as plays of Apple, the lossless codec that's sort of the most integrated into Apple and Final Cut land is QTRLE, QuickTime Real-Length Encoding, which is sort of an animation codec. It's really, really good for computer-animated files where you have, you know, nice solid colors and gradients, but the codec is very poor at compressing sort of real-world video or anything from an analog source. HuffyOv and FFV1, at particular bit depths and combinations, will work with Final Cut if you use if you get QuickTime and Final Cut to understand the libAV codec library from FFmpeg, which you can do with component called Parian, which is what City of Vancouver is using to get FFV1 to work well in their edit and production environments. So I put together this list of some considerations and questions to ask about the application of certain codecs within a given archival environment. And certainly, like, the benefit of using lossless codecs is for the most part, storage size. Like, you should be able to compress your video by about a third of what it would be in an uncompressed format. And this is sort of the same ratio in audio. For instance, if you have a broadcast WAV file, you can compress it to about 30% of the original size by using FLAC or APE. The video, uncompressed video, can be compressed to JPEG 2000, FFV1, or HAFI, or the other codecs to about a third. The codecs vary in efficiency by a couple percentage points, but generally about a third the size is what you can get for 8-bit video. If you increase the bit depth and you start using things like 10-bit or 12, 14, 16-bit, the amount of compression efficiency is reduced because then you're storing more noise than actual pattern data that's more compressible. So with 10-bit compression, you'd be expecting like 40 to 50% smaller than the original. But as far as these considerations, like one is the losslessness of this video codec application as a mathematician would understand it or as a marketing agent would understand it? And unfortunately, like the word lossless in digital video preservation is often applied to transformations of or processing of audiovisual that is certainly not lossless. For a lossless transcoding of a video to be purely lossless, the resulting video should have the exact same, pixel values as each pixel of the original one. Like if a certain pixel starts off in an RGB color space and it's 8-bit and these are the exact values, the resulting file should decode to that exact same thing so that the two files, the uncompressed original and the lossless file that you create, both present to identical sets of data at the same time. Between both of them, in the case of this environment, although we're starting from analog tapes, the analog tapes are digitized into a video card, like a Blackmagic card or an Aja card, that takes the SDI data in and sends out a digital video signal of raw uncompressed data, and that's sort of what the source material is for the FFV1 in this case. So the raw data coming out of the video card is then compressed down into FFV1 for storage. So another consideration is, can we decode this for the free software that's available? And also, can we decode it with available vendor-supported software? Sort of both are important, although I like one of these options a little more than the other one particularly. But, it's good to be using technology that's supported by multiple companies or has multiple stakeholders in the development and maintenance of the codec. Another one is, can this lossless codec represent pixel data according to the color space, chroma subsampling patterns, bit depths, and allowable ranges of data in the original source? With a lot of analog source material, like we're coming from videotape land, where the variation of technical specifications for video is very, very limited. Like if most of the analog tape that would be digitized in an environment like this is going to give you a 422 chroma subsampling pattern, it'll be in YUV. When you start to deal with original digital work, these rules are a lot more flexible. Whereas you can't necessarily change some of these specifications in tape, where it's sort of baked into the physical nature of the tape. There is a bit more variety with born digital works. Another consideration is, can the losslessness of the actual transcoding be verified? With FFmpeg as a transcoder, there's a method to verify losslessness because the source video can be decoded, and then instead of sending it to another encoder to make a different type of video, you can send the data to a checksum utility. So you can decode the frames one by one and make a checksum of each one. So if you have an original uncompressed file and then a resulting losslessly compressed file, when you decode them, the decoded data from the two sources should be identical and thus have matching frame checksums, line by line. So one of the deliverables I think that was in this project was delivering sort of a checksum list of the checksums of each decoded frame for the file, so that in addition to knowing like if the file as a whole is authentic or not, if the file as a whole wasn't for whatever reason, you could then use that data to drill down and figure out what exact frame had the corruption. Another consideration is, does anybody else know what this is? And this is sort of like why we're having this presentation, and to sort of introduce the codec to a wider audience. And then another important consideration is, can the archive also preserve the ability to decode and process this? If you're going to use a lossless codec, you have to be dedicated to understanding it, being able to control it, and being able to maintain the ability to decode and process it, as well as just maintaining like the ability to sort of have an evacuation route to a different set of specifications in the future. This is sort of similar to how if an archive has a massive collection of U-matic tapes, they better have a bunch of U-matic decks too. So in this case, the city of Vancouver loves Archive-matica, and this is sort of where the one of the major starting points of the development of the specification for this project. Archivematica has gotten a lot of shout-outs elsewhere in the conference, but particular to this project is Archivematica's license. It's put under an open GPL license. The documentation is open, and they work to make sure that the tools that they're including into the system of Archivematica, follow along with these licenses and can be distributed. So when there needed to be integration of lossless video handling in Archivematica, it sort of started this thread, which is you can find on Archivematica's Google group, called Encoding JPEG 2000 MXF Using Open Source Tools. And this is a very long thread going over a bunch of research to determine methods to use open source and free software that could be distributed in Archivematica to lead to the results that robots would lead to at Liberia Congress, to end up with JPEG 2000 in MXF. A lot of the solutions that are sort of outlined here would work in very, very specific cases. Some of them sort of have high risk. Some of them wouldn't work if you ever had source content that was variable frame rate, and some only work at certain color spaces or bit depths. In JPEG 2000 land, there's a lot of tools that are sort of designed specifically for RGB color space, because the still image community tends to work in RGB color space, and they're a little bit more, they've adapted JPEG 2000 a little bit more. But for video, we work in YUV color space, and if we had to transition from YUV to RGB in order to use a particular JPEG 2000 tool, would be introducing loss and rounding in the conversion that would sort of damper the whole reason why we would try to use a lossless codec in the first place. So sort of as a result of this research, we decided to look outside the box and see whatever available options there were. Oh, so I also wanted to point out with JPEG 2000 was sort of designed to work with what's called the MP4 family of audiovisual file format containers, which is QuickTime, MP4, JP2, Motion JPEG 2000. All those containers have a color chunk, and because JPEG 2000 isn't self-descriptive enough to say what color space it is or some of the particular technical specifications, there's this color chunk that's used to do that in the container that contains JPEG 2000. MXF didn't have this initially, so they had to develop SMPTE-422M, which is it's kind of an alternate to the color chunk to say, if you put JPEG 2000 in MXF, here's a particular set of rules that MXF has to follow to describe what's inside it. So that's SMPTE-422M. So because of this, you can have a system that supports MXF and supports JPEG 2000, but doesn't support them in combination. Because in order to support them in combination, you also have a system that follows the guidelines of SMPTE-422M to be able to interpret the contents of the MXF file. So there's an additional rule of complexity of it. So we started looking at FFV1, and as a choice in digital video preservation, it's been slowly evolving as different researchers or digital preservationists do testing, to sort of decide on their own which digital video codec, which lossless codec would be most fit with a particular technical environment. And FFV1's been independently come to as a conclusion in a few different environments. So FFV1 was originally introduced in 2003, and it's licensed under LGPL version 2. And its sort of host organization is FFmpeg, which is an extremely popular audiovisual processing tool. It's used in the back ends of things like YouTube, Facebook, Google Chrome, and a variety of websites. A huge amount of the video that we see online or on television has gone through this set of tools at one point. Generally, if you're trying to start from scratch and develop a video processing tool, it's a huge nightmare to write a bunch of codecs and decoders for all the different various specifications that are out there. It is so much easier to use collaboration to get a huge team of developers together to develop the libraries that are available in FFmpeg. So in development of open source video tools, it's a de facto thing that FFmpeg will be integrated in some way to decode it. And FFmpeg's been integrated into more and more proprietary audiovisual processing tools like Rosette Carbon Coder and some other tools, because they allow licenses that support that. So this is the timeline of FFV1 development. It was added as an experimental codec in 2003, and a lot of its initial use was as an intermediate codec so that somebody could start processing or editing, manipulating video, and then they could stop, save it in FFV1 losslessly, and then pick up and continue on it later. Whereas normally if you stop and save a video file and then reopen it later, you might be transcoding it over and over and degrading the file as you go. So lossless codecs are often used sort of in an intermediate process. Like in Apple and Final Cut land, there's like Apple Intermediate Codec and ProRes would be the most equivalent of this. So FFV1 stayed in experimental status until 2006, and then it had gone through enough review process to drop the experimental label. Earlier this year, there's been more effort to provide a new version, version 3 of FFV1. Version 2 was never released. It just all kind of rolled into the development of version 3. So version 3 is available and still under experimental status, but I'm really excited about the progress of version 3 because it's, you know, it's sort of an extension of the codec that's taken in a huge amount of input from the open source codec development community and has also had a lot of participation by other digital preservationists and archivists. So FFV1, like if you go to FFmpeg and, you know, look up FFV1, you can see the history of the development of the decoders and encoders for this are extremely open. You can see all the progress since the original commitment of the codec and all the related discussion. Archivematica is also, you know, because of this process, project has been integrated into Archivematica. So Archivematica will use FFV1 for the normalization of video. So if video comes into Archivematica that is, you know, broken or obscure or risking obsolescence, you know, or I think, you know, pretty much just all video that goes into Archivematica will be normalized to FFV1 as a codec for long-term storage. And, of course, the original file submitted to Archivematica is maintained as well. Another place where FFV1 is supported and made more accessible is through a plugin for Windows called FFDshow Tryouts. When you install this package, it just sort of enables like the whole library of libAV codec from FFmpeg to be accessible as system-level codecs in the Windows environment. Because of that, it led to the release of DVA Profession by the Österreich MediaTek, which is, you know, a comprehensive system for digitizing, managing metadata, and tracking audiovisual assets through the digitization process. And they use it with, you know, a particular set of hardware, but then all open software to make sure that you're ingesting analog audio video material into a lossless codec targeted. So getting back to FF version 3 and sort of what's coming up in the development, the three major things coming out of this are that it's going to be multi-threaded for encoding and decoding. And in a computer processor, this means when you have to take uncompressed video and turn it into lossless codec, it's very mathematically intensive to do so. So FFV1 with supporting multithreading will take all that math and sort of divide it across the processors of the computer so that if you have like an 8-core computer, it'll happen much faster than if you have a single-core computer. So it makes the encoding speed much, much faster. With version 3 of FFV1, it's about 2.5 to 3 times faster than the prior version, and the prior version was itself a lot faster than most JPEG 2000 software encoders can go. You know, so you can get much faster than real-time performance out of this. Another thing that's very important for long-term preservation is that FFV1 adds a mandatory checksum in the frame header so that it's clear when you're decoding the file if it has changed since it was originally encoded. And then there's also a large amount of documentation efforts going on. So here's some speed tests. Hey, let me just find the good stuff because I'm over time. Oh, so this, I don't know, shout out to Zuf, which is a data fuzzer. This is a tool you can use to force digital corruption on your materials, which is really good for testing repository environments. You know, so, you know, I could take it and take JPEG 2000 and damage it to see how JPEG 2000 would degrade. You know, here's how FFV1 would degrade because it's sliced because of the multi-threading. This image was split across 6 cores, so the corruption happens in an isolated way. But you can see at the bottom of the frame, like the FFV1 decoder can report out to say which frame is damaged, so that there's sort of a self-awareness of digital corruption in the FFV1 codec in particular. And specifications underway and developed. You can see all the versioning if you check out this website. Here's some links. That's it. Yeah. All right. Thank you.
Do me a favor. Open that PowerPoint. Since we're going through this so fast, if anybody wants more specific information, I'm sure that any of us could share any of our slides with you, our presentations with you. So how does this all come together? Well, Audiovisual Preservation Solutions, Dave Rice, worked with the City of Vancouver, and they came up with this solution as to how they were going to move forward with preserving their video. So they called us, and they said, hey, we want to do FFV1. And I scratched my head and said, what the heck is FFV1? Well, long and short, we did some research. We have programmers on staff who develop tools to create FFV1. And once we got into this, we found out that we really, really liked the way FFV1 worked. And I know that Dave addressed a lot of issues regarding JPEG 2000. And one of the things that we run into as we're talking to archives a lot is they say, hey, well, it's good for the Library of Congress. It should be good for me. Well, yeah, you don't have the kind of resources that the Library of Congress has. And even though JPEG 2000 has been around for about the last 10 years, we're still struggling to gain a lot of support in the industry. There's really only a couple of hardware manufacturers that create solutions to or create hardware encoding solutions to create JPEG 2000 in a lossy environment, and there's really no good way to play it back in software. There are some hardware decoders, but software's kind of difficult. So these are some of the things that we particularly like about FFV1, and I'll address some of those here in just a minute when I contrast some of the common formats that are used for preservation as compared to JPEG 2000 and FFV1. So one of the challenges that you're faced with, and this has been alluded to, there's no standards in the video preservation world. So you're going to have all these different formats in your archive. You're going to have some extinct formats where equipment hasn't been manufactured in the last 20 years. It's really, really difficult to find operating equipment. It's really difficult to find replacement parts. You're going to have endangered formats, outdated formats, and even some current formats. And one of the things that you have to look at is as you're transferring these formats, what's the potential source of the original format? Oh, I'm sorry. Cindy already addressed some of this stuff, so I'm not going to go through this. So one of the things that you have to look at is when you're looking at the codecs that you use, what's the source format? What are the capabilities of the source format versus what am I going to create to preserve? Because you want to make sure that you utilize a format that has the capability of preserving all the potential content of the original. So one of the things that you have to think about when you're doing a preservation project or a digitization project is, what are your goals? Am I trying to preserve the content, or am I trying to create access to the content? As I mentioned, does the chosen format preserve all of the potential quality of the original? And to give you an example of what I mean, if you're starting with a second or third generation VHS tape, you might not need to go to lossless compression or uncompressed to capture all the potential resolution of that particular format. In fact, a lot of people would just suggest you go with something like a DV format or something of that nature. The only thing you have to be careful of is when you start looking at a lot of other formats out there, they're lossy, meaning that you lose something from the original when you create it. So you just have to take that into consideration when you're choosing different formats for your digitization. And also, is it future-proof, or as Dave alluded to, as future-proof as it can be based on what we have available today. So you heard some of this today about lossless and 10-bit and 8-bit and compressed and lossy and different things of that nature. Well, I thought it would be helpful to approach this from kind of a practical standpoint. When we're talking about uncompressed files, and we're talking about things like QuickTime or AVI, 8-bit, you're looking at somewhere around 72 gigabytes per hour. For 10-bit, that actually increases. You're looking at 100 or even maybe a little bit more than 100 gigabytes an hour. So this is why compression is of interest to us. For compressed files, and I'm specifically talking about lossless compression here, for 8-bit, you can get down in the 25 to 30 gigabyte range. As Dave mentioned, maybe a third of the file size of the original. For 10-bit, you're probably looking at a little bit larger, maybe 45 to 50 gigabytes per hour. So you know, if you're saving an hour or two of video, this might not make a big difference. But when you're talking hundreds of hours or thousands of hours, this starts to make a huge difference. I can't really talk about lossless formats without also addressing some of the common lossy formats that are out there. One that everybody's heard of, I'm sure, is MPEG-2. There's a tremendous amount of video that's, even today, is still created utilizing the MPEG-2 format. Couple challenges with MPEG-2, it's not easily editable. There are forms of MPEG-2 that are editable, but they're not the common forms that most of us are used to dealing with. But the nice thing about MPEG-2 is it's a really efficient codec. We can get file sizes down to about 3.6 gigabytes per hour if you're using a DVD data rate, which is a relatively low data rate, to somewhere maybe in the neighborhood of around 25 gigabytes an hour for a really, really high-quality MPEG-2. DV is an editable format. It's used natively by a lot of very prolific editing systems, like Final Cut Pro as an example. Avid is compatible with DV. Adobe Premiere is compatible with DV. A lot of people that are doing lower cost acquisition, like production and whatnot, they acquire on DV because it's an inexpensive format to acquire on. The decks are inexpensive, the tape stock's inexpensive, the cameras are inexpensive. So it's very widely used throughout the industry. So we see a lot of organizations that are encoding to the DV format. And then MPEG-4. You know, up until about a year or two ago, we didn't really have a lot of people settle on a streaming file that they were using. It was kind of across the board. People were using Flash, people were using Windows Media, people were using QuickTime. Well, we've kind of seen it settle now onto MPEG-4, and a lot of people are using MPEG-4. Again, very widely used out there in the industry. You're seeing YouTube, a lot of the news broadcasters and whatnot have settled on MPEG-4, and a lot of archives have settled on MPEG-4 for their access copies. There are some advantages to open source, at least some advantages that we've identified, and I'm trying to be aware of our time here. We're approaching the end of our allotted time. So I'm going to go through this pretty quickly. Here's what we see as far as advantages to open source versus what I'm going to call off-the-shelf solutions. Open source, widely available, usually free or low cost. If you remember when Red Hat Linux, or when Linux first came out, and Red Hat was kind of the first company to really monetize Linux and give you some additional support and whatnot, that's what I mean by low-cost solutions as compared to, you know, going to Apple or Microsoft or something of that nature and purchasing a solution. The developers tend to be very passionate about what they're developing. They're very interested in this. So they actually will develop what the market needs. And I'll address this issue in a second, because if any of you are familiar with Final Cut Pro, you know what Apple just did with the new version of Final Cut Pro and how that kind of hurt a lot of the professional users for what I'm going to call an off-the-shelf solution. You would expect that open source should be less prone to market changes. As Dave had shown with the FFV1 as an example, you can go all the way back to the beginning. You can see all the development all the way back to the beginning. So if anything, if you have a question about anything or anything changes, you can actually see where it came from. And it tends to be more flexible with respect to users' needs. However, on the downside, open source isn't for everybody. Open source usually requires a pretty strong technical background. Tech support isn't as available for open source solutions as it is for other solutions. Now, that's not to say it's not available. You just have to know the right questions to ask and where to go to get the information. But you're not going to call an 800 number and get a technician on the phone to be able to help you with this. So there are some downsides to open source, and you should consider this if this is something that you're considering for your particular archive. So converse to the open source solutions, you have purchase solutions. Well, there's some advantages to open source solutions. There's some financial incentives for the organizations to provide solutions for what the mass audience wants. Think of the iPhone and Apple. That is probably the best example of how a purchase solution appealed to a mass audience and made Apple a whole heck of a lot of money. It can be easier to use. What I mean by that is they'll develop graphical user interfaces and whatnot. The solutions are really designed with the non-technical user in mind as compared to some open source solutions, which really aren't. And again, generally good tech support is available. Usually you have 24/7 tech support where you can call somebody and they can help you work through the problem that you're having. However, with off-the-shelf solutions, it's usually subject to manufacturer's whims. And what I alluded to earlier about Final Cut Pro, well, Final Cut Pro 7 was the last version of Final Cut before the new version, which is Final Cut X. In Final Cut X, Apple eliminated all support for any projects created in Final Cut 7 and does not allow you the ability to import any items created in Final Cut 7. Well, Final Cut 7 was what all the professional editing facilities use. So now they come out with Final Cut X, which really appears to be more geared toward a consumer-based audience. And it just resulted in all kinds of outcry from the professional users because they can't use it. Apple promises they're going to fix it. They haven't done so yet. So you have some challenges there of, yeah, it's a great tool. Yeah, Apple's a wonderful company. Yeah, they provide great support. But they decided to change it. Now all of a sudden it's different than it was. And everything that you created before is no longer supported. I just want to do, kind of finishing up here, I have this and one or two more slides. Here's some real-world examples of working with different formats out there in the industry. And I'm not sure how many of you have tried working with these different formats, but this is from a user standpoint and some of the difficulty associated, or maybe not so difficulty associated with using these different formats. Uncompressed QuickTime. Most of the people that are requesting uncompressed files, that seems to be what they're requesting. Here's one of the challenges. The files are absolutely gargantuan. And if you try to play them back, QuickTime, for whatever reason, is very computer horsepower intensive. It requires a lot of computer resources to play it back. So unless you have all but the fastest computers, like editing or workstation class systems, QuickTime's going to stutter and hitch on playback. There's not a whole heck of a lot you can do with that. It's just really, really computer intensive. However, it is widely supported, it's widely used, and the QuickTime container does offer some additional capabilities. For example, if you can embed certain amounts of metadata and whatnot within the QuickTime container itself. AVI, again, files are just as large as QuickTime, but they are a little bit easier to play back. It's not as computer intensive or computer resource intensive as QuickTime is, but it's a little bit more limited in the capabilities that it has as far as things that you can put in the container and whatnot. FFV1, again, when we started working with FFV1, we really liked the way FFV1 works. At this point, it is standardized. The file size is reasonable. The one thing we like about it is supported on multiple different operating systems, so it is supported on Windows, Macintosh, Linux. It can be played in software. That's in direct contrast to other lossless compression formats, for example, like JPEG 2000. And it is gaining acceptance out there in the industry. I don't want you to get the impression that I hate JPEG 2000. I don't. But as I said, it's been around for quite a long time. We're still really waiting for it to gain acceptance. You will have people out there tell you, oh, yeah, it's the greatest thing. Yes, it is gaining acceptance. Yeah, but it's still really difficult to work with. It's still really difficult to play back. There's some advantages, I think, to exploring other options like FFV1 as compared to using, for example, JPEG 2000 as a lossless codec. So I rushed through that really quick. I apologize for that. But again, we were very limited on time. It is now about 1:20, so we have about 10 minutes for question and answer, so please feel free.
Yes?
The phrase you use, gaining acceptance, trips the bell to people. You look at the open source community. If you go to somewhere like SourceForge, the overwhelming majority of all products often on SourceForge are supported by one person. So are there objective threshold criteria that one could use to say, this is an open source product that has gained enough acceptance or that I think has some future-proofedness for at least a viable period of time?
Dude, can you address that?
Sure. So the question was, is there a sustainability, some factors to evaluate how sustainable an open source project is? So FFV1 was authored as like one of the two codecs that the FFmpeg project has developed, and I certainly know, like I see on GitHub and SourceForge that there's a huge amount of open source projects that are developed and then sort of abandoned. The authorship is limited to a very small group. Things are sort of released but not necessarily maintained. I can say on FFmpeg in particular, if you go to their website and you look at their GitHub, you can see that there are typically over 100 changes a day pushed into FFmpeg from dozens and dozens of users. I get the development listserv and the user listserv, and they're by far like way more massive than any of the archival listservs that I get. The amount of people sort of invested in FFmpeg as an organization is enormous. They've established a foundation. They can take donations and then use those donations as bounties to encourage developers to resolve bugs and fixes and development. So I would say FFmpeg is it's an organization that fluctuates a lot because it's very volunteer based, but it's filled with very passionate people who have very specific areas of maintaining different codecs and filters and functions. I'd say if you see an open source project and it hasn't had any changes in the last year, it's time to start to be worried about things. you know, but as far as open source projects, FFmpeg is like, you know, one of the leaders in sort of ongoing development, maintenance, and having like an internal governing structure that is sustaining the organization. How's that? Any more questions, or do you have to add?
I was just going to say that the other advantage to using an open source format is that if something does happen, then we have access, so we can actually hire a programmer if necessary to get our stuff out. Whereas if it was proprietary and something happened and it wasn't supported anymore, then we couldn't do anything to get our content back. So. Oh, we've silenced the crowd. Oh. No.
I have a quick question.
Yeah.
You had mentioned that some software or something that was downloadable. I didn't get the name.
MD5 checker, right?
Yeah.
MD5 checker. All right. Oh, I guess it's time for everybody.
Hi, George. You're good for a question.
What about things outside the raster? So we're talking about compressing the image and the sound or capturing that. What would you do in a situation where there were other streams to address, whether time code or closed captioning or other things that get stuck in the vertical line again?
Sure. Well, both FFV1 and JPEG 2000 are like image-only compression standards. Like if you took out the whole raster of of SDI, you could, you know, compress it all in one of these things as image. But like in the case of the City of Vancouver archive, like the audio goes into like linear PCM audio tracks, and then the metadata section of the container is used for a lot of the preservation metadata as far as like what deckware came from, timecode data. And then I know with some of the capture cards like Azure and Blackmagic, it'll redirect some of the caption data from line 21 into a C608 track, so that you'll have timecode, captions, audio, and video all in separate tracks within a QuickTime container, all encoded in, you know, their own independent ways. Yeah, but it's true. Like our presentation only focused on like that one type of data in the container, like the video specifically.
One of the challenges, George, and I'm sure you're aware of this too, one of the challenges that we're always faced with is, what do you do with that information? What do you do if there's closed captioning on the original? What do you do if there's time code in the original? Because a lot of the codecs themselves, just the raw codec itself, has no provision for handling that. MPEG 2, as an example, doesn't know what to do with closed captioning. It blanks it out. A lot of these codecs, if there's time code in the original, it doesn't have anything to do with it. So we generally treat that as a sidecar type file and capture it in another way and include it in the container. In the case of FFV1, that would be the Matroska container. In the case of maybe JPEG 2000, it'd be the MXF container.
What's been the support among, say, the industrial transcoders? You know, there was, up until I think version 5, Final Cut did support lossless J2K, and then Apple dropped it unceremoniously.
It supported it, but it only supported it in RGB A color space. So you had to, most of our video has chroma subsampling, and you'd have to sort of eliminate all the storage benefits of using chroma subsampling. And I think it was only with an alpha channel, so you'd have to add an entire other channel that didn't exist in the source material. So the Kakadu JPEG 2000 codec in QuickTime, for at least the video community, couldn't really be used in a lossless way. Although, you know, it could for sort of still images that are more geared towards that color space and, you know,
well,
that pattern.
Where I was heading with the question was actually with regards to the FFV1. And the central tenet of sustainability is the level of adoption, not just its simplicity that it's open source, but that there's, you know, a broad base of support for it. What is the support under the FFV1, or FFmpeg handles FFV1, but, you know, does Telestream or Rosette or any of these other industrial coders?
I believe, like, Rosette incorporates the codec library from FFmpeg, libav codec, so I haven't tested it, but I believe it would be able to process FFV1 just because of the nature of it, including that disseminated library. And then, other like libAV codec is like one of the most widely distributed codec libraries. So if you took FFV1 and uploaded it to YouTube, YouTube would process it and then, you know, show you a derivative, and same with the Internet Archive. And then, you know, often like there are these, you know, there are projects like the Parian component that sort of builds a bridge between Final Cut's QuickTime library and libAV codec so that those decoders can be used in that environment. You know, in that way, like, the files that John was producing with FFV1, like, could be brought into Final Cut and just edited on directly, you know, without having to go through a transitional process. But you know, it's true, Apple themselves doesn't include it in the package and send it out. And similarly, in a Windows environment, you'd have to use that FFD show tryouts plugin, which gives you access to FFV1 as an encoder or decoder and just puts it in sort of in the system level of codecs. And that's what Osterreich MediaTek has used, so they can just go direct from tape to lossless FFV1 in their ingest. Cool. Any more questions? Hey.
Cindy, I think, mentioned AV Atlas. What is that used for?
It's a website where you users can upload clips of video that have problems with them and then point out where the problem is and then tell you what caused that problem and whether or not it can be fixed. Yeah, it's a wiki that people can contribute to. It's pretty cool.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Actually, I don't think we have any Wi-Fi.
No, we don't have Wi-Fi here. We could have done that.
So when you get home, you can look at it.
Yeah,
check
it
out. It's more of a training
tool. Yeah.
So what place you go to learn about something looked funny and why? Yeah. Is it something that's fixable or is it inherent in the format?
All right. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Perfect.